Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Pandor from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
Today we have two items on our agenda. First, we'll discuss the outcomes, or lack thereof, of the U.S.-China strategic and economic dialogue, following which we'll move on to discuss the current electoral crisis in Afghanistan. So Zach, let's just jump right into it. What's your take on this strategic and economic dialogue? Did the U.S. and China accomplish anything significant in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the money the U.S. taxpayers spent to send the delegation to Washington was, or to Beijing, was probably more than it was worth given the outcomes. I mean, I'm wondering if this even, if the strategic and economic dialogue even really continues to survive if it keeps going like this. I mean, the strategic element of it's pretty new. It started under Secretary Clinton. I mean, it just, they don't seem to have accomplished much of anything. So I really just think this highlights how bad relations have been. I mean, under President Xi and Obama, they've pledged to forge a new type of great power relations, and I just think this goes to show that, I mean, they have the same type of great power relations that every other rising and established power had in the past, or at least it's looking like it's going that direction. What about you? What do you think?
No, I mean, I absolutely agree with your last point there. I mean, there's a reason that Thucydidean trap is referred to as a trap and not anything else. It's because it's quite difficult to escape, and it doesn't look like the U.S. and China are doing a good job of escaping it at all. I mean, my take on the strategic and economic dialogue is, you know, it is one of Secretary Clinton and the Obama administration's pet projects in terms of improving relations with China, but really it's just turned into a state of the relationship event. I mean, for, you know, people like us who watch China and watch U.S.-China relations, the strategic and economic dialogue is a nice way to just wrap up the issues that are hampering the U.S.-China relationship right now more than anything. I mean, if you look at the actual dialogue in Beijing, I mean, they almost, you know, they touch on almost every single aspect of the problems that are plaguing the two countries. I mean, everything from cyber espionage to, you know, more strategic issues like the U.S. alliance system in Asia.
Yeah, but I think that's – I almost think that's one of the problems. I feel like the Soviet Union, the U.S., when they like, obviously engaged, but they usually focused on issues where they had mutual interests. This is, seems like they want to – the U.S. and the China strategic dialogue is just focused on everything. We're going to include every single issue, and then nothing gets accomplished on anything. And, I mean, I think it's the belief – this is from the belief that, like, if we can get cooperate on some of these low-level, like, soft issues, like, you know, I don't know, whatever, environmental stuff or medicine stuff or student exchanges, that will, like, serve as a foundation to solve the harder issues. And I just think they need to narrow it down and focus either on the issues that are most important or the issues that are pretty important, that but they're where there's, like, some mutual interest involved. Like, the Middle East, they have a lot of such interest, same of a lot of the same interests in the Middle East. They should focus on cooperation there, or something like that.
Absolutely. I mean, why don't we talk about a few of the ways, and you know, the type of great power relationship between the U.S. and China is actually like any other great power relationship. I mean, I think one of the best ways we see that is in the competing vision set out for Asian security that we saw at the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. I mean, one thing we should also note is that when the dialogue started, you know, Xi was not in power. That was back in the Hu and Wen era, which was a very, very different era of Chinese leadership, as we're learning with Xi Jinping. I mean, Xi hearkened back to his ideas from the CICA conference on, you know, Asia for Asians. Basically, the idea that the Asian security order should be run by Asian countries, and which essentially means that the United States shouldn't play a major role. And Kerry essentially rebutted that in Beijing by saying that the United States will have as many allies as it sees fit in the Asia-Pacific region, and that it is not actively containing China. So we do see that, you know, that this sort of competition between two different visions for Asia, which really shows that, you know, China is, to some extent, a revisionist power here. This is the meeting of a status quo hegemon and a revisionist power with aspirations for regional hegemony. That's all it is. I mean, there's no new type of great power relations really going on here. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's really the problem, is that there's been this whole feeling that, you know, they could avoid this the Thucydidean trap and stuff if they just, like, talked and, you know, because in the other cases, the rising and established power didn't talk, or, like, you know, it seems like they felt like the reason why this happened, where they went to war, why they competed so fiercely, was because, like, these two powers, like, you know, had, like, unreasonable leaders or leaders that didn't want peace and stuff. And that's just wrong. The problem is with the rising and established powers that they have competing interests. They're in many ways diametrically opposed. They can't be reconciled. China wants the regional hegemony, and the U.S. doesn't want China to become the regional hegemon. So, I mean, I don't know how you exactly reconcile
that. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, like, you look at U.S.-China relations today and how there's just this general air of unease across the board. I mean, in the past, you had, you know, you had these acute events that would flare up a major crisis. You had, you know, Tiananmen Square, you had the Taiwan Strait crisis, you had the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And these days, there's just kind of this general air of unease. I mean, there's no, like, major incident. I mean, sure, you have minor things happening, like the Cowpens incident, the U.S. indictment of PLA officers, the ADIZ. I mean, that might have been a little bit more major, but, I mean, you get the... There's just these like little things that keep happening that just show you how far the U.S. and China have to go to actually change their bilateral relationship.
Yeah, but I just think also, like, I mean, first of all, I think there's a general like constant crisis in East Asia, largely not even just with the U.S. and China, but with China and like Southeast. I mean, it seems like this is constant now. It's not like there's every like once a year there'll be a flare up in the South China Sea or the East China Sea. There'll be like there's just constantly like a low-level crisis going on. Sometimes it goes a little, flares up a little higher, like with the oil rig, but it seems to be just like constantly there now. But again, like I think this whole idea, you hear with Chinese, I feel like Chinese scholars in particular, but even a lot of their American counterparts, they talk about how important it is to build trust and how there's this mistrust plaguing the U.S.-China relationship. It's all about like they need to find trust and stuff, and I just don't think that's the right thing. I think they do. They don't trust each other. It's not because they don't understand each other. It's because they do understand each other. They realize that they have different goals and that the other one could, you know, get in the way of their own goals. So I think they know each other very well, and that's exactly why they don't trust each other, and they shouldn't trust each other given their goals.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, that's where diplomacy comes in. I mean, a lot of diplomacy is doing business with people you don't trust and trying to make something of that. And I think, you know, to the credit of both Chinese and U.S. diplomats, I mean, I think – this is as good as things could be right now. I mean, given the national interests on both sides, I think, you know, there is, sure, there might be a little bit of room for improvement in some areas. But, you know, it doesn't really get much better than this for the U.S. and China. I mean, one other issue I wanted to bring up is that under Xi, China has been keener on developing its partnerships with other countries, proving that it doesn't need that excellent relationship with the United States to actually succeed in Asia. I mean, you have Russia, South Korea, Germany that China is pursuing closer relationships with, you know, as we saw with Xi's visit to Seoul recently. So it's really, you know, China is branching out and taking on a more independent foreign policy. And I think as it's doing that, we're going to see relationship with the United States decline.
Yeah, I think China's really trying to take advantage. I think it sees that this now the U.S. getting pulled in the Middle East and Europe, and I think it sees kind of like this is maybe the one last opportunity for like the Asia pivot really gets underway for it to you know gain some ground while the U.S. is distracted. So, and I also think I've heard this a lot recently, talking to people and even reading that like President Xi doesn't respect the Obama administration and the second team that's the new team that's taken over, like Chuck Hagel and John Kerry in particular, and they just don't really have much respect anymore, and they kind of see this as like a good opportunity to push the boundaries a little bit while the U.S. is distracted and while the leadership's in power. So, I mean, I agree with you that it's probably not going to improve the Sino-U.S. bilateral relationship. It's not going to improve in isolation, but I think that, you know, if the U.S. was put more pressure on China through building up alliances and stuff, that might make China change its behavior stiff. And on the other hand, like, you know, if China improved its relationship significantly with Vietnam, the Philippines, Japan, I mean, I'm not sure I'll do it, but if it did, I think the U.S. would feel pressure to have to improve too. Otherwise, it's going to be the odd man out with the as far as the tensions with China.
Right, absolutely. Let's take this discussion over to our second topic for today. We'll come back to U.S.-China relations several times on this podcast, I'm sure. I wanted to talk about, you know, the election crisis in Afghanistan. For listeners that aren't aware, Afghanistan's runoff election results have been a little bit controversial. Not a little bit. That's actually an understatement. One of the candidates, Abdullah, the Tajik candidate, has refused to accept the results of the election, alleging that his opponent's camp, Ashraf Ghani, ballot stuffed and carried out huge electoral fraud across the country. So essentially, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, right after the strategic and economic dialogue with China, flew to Kabul, where he is currently trying to defuse this crisis. I mean, the stakes are really high for Afghanistan. Both Ghani and Abdullah are backed by warlords across the country, and they're actually geographically distinct. Most of Ghani's supporters are towards the south, traditionally Pashtun side of the country, and Abdullah's Tajik supporters primarily are towards the northern end of Afghanistan. So I think, you know, Some analysts are concerned that this might, if this election turns out to result in violence, which it hasn't so far, there have only been protests, peaceful protests largely, that this could significantly destabilize Afghanistan. Zach, what's your reading on this situation? What is the United States to do about Afghanistan now?
I don't know. I don't think there's much it can do. I think this really just – I think the best thing the U.S. should do in watching what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan is maybe if it ever has to do those kind of things again, it should probably scale back its ambitions. I mean, I think that the real problem is that heterogeneous societies – it's very hard to establish democracies in heterogeneous societies when these societal groups are just like hate each other for who they are, don't trust each other for who they are, rather than like what they do. I mean, I think there's a real chance that we're gonna see Iraq type situations in the next in the coming weeks and months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think what's actually quite tragic about the Afghanistan situation is that after the April 5th election, the whole ethnicization argument didn't really, there was no evidence for that during the first election. I mean, Afghans went to the polls, they voted, everybody was optimistic about Afghan democracy. There was really, relatively little fraud. The Afghan National Security Forces did a good job of maintaining security, and then it all fell apart at this runoff. And I think now, unfortunately, I think many Afghans are starting to lose faith in their democracy. And, it's not a good sign. I mean, watching the U.S. Secretary of State fly in to resolve an election that should have been by the Afghans for the Afghans. I mean, it just looks like the United States is intervening in Afghanistan's politics again, possibly undermining its constitution. I mean, I wrote a piece about this today, and just some things that Kerry should not definitely do in Afghanistan include, trying to broker a power-sharing agreement between the two candidates that creates a new sort of political position in Afghanistan that doesn't exist according to the constitution. I mean, I feel like doing something like that is just unwise at this point. It really interferes in Afghan politics, undermines its constitution, and just doesn't give Afghan citizens the kind of faith that they need in their country. I mean, I think one of the agreements or one of the proposals that's floating around is to have Abdullah, if he did actually lose this election to Ghani, become a sort of prime minister, which would allow him to share power with Ghani in an extent. But I just don't think that's a good idea at this junction.
Yeah, well, I'm almost reminded by your warning. I think your warnings are right. And I'm reminded of the last presidential election with Richard Holbrooke, who at least in Karzai's view, and I think a lot of people's view, was basically trying to prop up Abdullah Abdullah. Not originally Abdullah Abdullah, originally someone else, but then Abdullah Abdullah. Basically, he was actively intervening to try to ensure that Hamid Karzai lost that election. And that really, I think, was the beginning of the end for U.S. relations with Karzai. I mean, they've been terrible since that election. And I think Karzai was furious over that. So I do think that the U.S. getting too involved is a bad idea. But I mean, I just don't see, the original elections went off without a hitch, without a lot of violence or whatever. But I just think that these deeper issues are here, that they don't trust the the different ethnic groups don't trust the Pashtuns, and they're getting very nervous now that the U.S. is leaving, and they fear the Taliban coming back. They suffered horribly, and they think that the Pashtuns are going to welcome the Taliban back, and that's going to, their families are going to be possibly threatened,
Yeah.
There's not much you can bargain about when you just really just don't like those, you don't trust those people. It's like the U.S. and China relationship. There's not a lot of potential for cooperation if you have diametrically opposing interests.
Yeah, I mean, the only good option, in my view right now, is for there's a proposal by the United Nations to conduct an impartial audit of the election, essentially separating the fraudulent votes and recounting the votes that are legitimate. Right now, Kerry's trying to get Abdullah to essentially agree to that audit. And if he does that, Abdullah originally said, he's been changing his demands a lot over the past week. He originally said that if he would see a credible counting of only legitimate votes and it turned out that he lost, he would concede defeat. So I think, that's really the only option right now. And, for Kerry, there's another consideration on the table, which is the bilateral security agreement. I mean, if the United States doesn't have a new Afghan president to work with by the end of August, it might be too late just logistically for the BSA to ever become a reality, because, the United States will have to plan for its withdrawal by the end of the year without the BSA. So that timer is also ticking for Kerry.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good point. I hadn't really considered but the BSA agreement is going to be hugely impacted by this. But I would say your other point about Abdullah Abdullah claiming if he saw a credible vote count, I mean, of course he's not going to be like, I'm going to accept a credible vote count. I really don't think that this has much to do with electoral fraud. I mean, I'm sure it does have some, but I mean, I think again, it's these deeper issues about who should control power. It's not about the integrity of Iran, Afghan elections. It's about who's going to be in power. You know, what different ethnic groups and how that's going to affect the other ones. As far as, you know, is the Taliban going to be welcome back? So I think that, you know, there's probably always a lot of electoral fraud. I don't doubt that at all. But I think that Abdullah Abdullah is not so worried about the integrity of the elections as he is that, you know, the Pashtuns are going to be in power, and he knows there's going to be no way that you can really definitively prove to his liking that the elections were free and fair. So he loses nothing by saying that. Of course he's going to say
right,
that.
Right, right. That's a good point. I mean, also, like, I think Abdullah's camp was particularly shocked by the fact that, you know, in the April 5th preliminary election, he had a several percentage point lead over Ghani. And then in this election, it turns out that Ghani is comfortably ahead. And also, I mean, you know, the big thing that gave it away was that the Independent Election Commission announced 7 million votes when, I believe, the first election in April, which was also for, you know, provisional for provincial seats and other seats as well, only had 6 million voters. So that's a huge margin. That's not adding up here.
Yeah, I should reemphasize that. I think it's it seems impossible there wasn't widespread fraud given the discrepancies between the first election and the runoff directors. I mean, it would literally be like all the Pashtun, like tens of thousands or Pashtuns that didn't show up, that normally don't show up, all of a sudden decide to come, and that like all the Abdullah supporters just stayed home, and even though they voted in the first election. I mean, it's not credible this happened, but again, I think that this whole the actual fraud issue is a little bit sort of a front for these deeper issues.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely like a long-term problem here to be solved in Afghanistan, obviously, which has, you know, been the country's perpetual issue. And you're absolutely right that that's definitely underlying a lot of this.
Can I ask you real quick on what you think is Pakistan's view on this? Because I think that, you know, to the extent that it fears maybe Afghanistan breaking up or a Pashtun entity emerging, an independent one, I mean, that would, I would think, threaten its interest given the Pashtuns on its side of the border, right? Or what's his view here?
I mean, it depends what you're talking about in Pakistan. If you're talking about the civilian government, then yes, I believe, you know, some people there are legitimately concerned about this. But if you're talking about the ISI and the traditional military interests in Pakistan that have always, you know, seen Afghanistan as a client state to Pakistan that's been perpetually unstable, I mean, I think that, you know, some people there would be quite pleased with this, potentially, you know, undermining U.S. interests in Afghanistan and essentially, you know, not allowing Afghanistan to fall into the Indian sphere of influence if the Taliban were to become resurgent there. So there are, I think it's a mixed picture from Pakistan right now.
I'm kind of confused. Is the Afghan and Pakistan border from the top to bottom, is that all Pashtun controlled areas on the
roughly up north? There are a few Tajik controls area near like Badakhshan and the Wakhan corridor into the Hindu Kush. That area is a little bit that area isn't really dominated by Pashtuns, but it's still used as a refuge by several insurgent groups. But it's primarily the main eastern border there.
Okay, so it does have an interest then, as far as like, you know, as long as it can keep it from swallowing up its Pashtun parts, it has an interest in like having it as a buffer state, as a Pashtun state, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's been somewhat of a permanent grand strategic interest in Pakistan, at least in the military. I mean, the new civilian government is obviously, you know, very different. They have, I think, you know, they legitimately want to see Afghanistan have some degree of stability for economic and commercial reasons as well. But, you know, there are good strategic reasons for Pakistan to want Afghanistan to be unstable in the long run.
And even possibly split up into like Pashtun and non-Pashtun parts?
I don't know about that, because then you know, if you did have a Pashtunistan emerge on the border of Pakistan, you know, that could emerge as a coherent state that could begin to undermine Pakistani interests. I think they do want Afghanistan to remain this sort of basket case that's on the verge of splitting up but never quite does, and just becomes a playing field for warlords, which is, you know, what we've seen over the past two decades before the U.S. invasion.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at. Is like, I think that to the extent this does threaten the unity of the Afghan state, I mean, I think Pakistan actually could play a positive role for once in terms of, I'm not necessarily sure it would want to see that break up because of the threat of Pashtunistan or whatever would pose to it. So that's like maybe one positive thing, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the little silver lining here. Anyways, thanks a lot for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week with more. Thanks a lot, Zach.
Thank you.